study. We've been looking at some things to do with the end times, looking at several different questions. Last week, we were in midst of discussing what do we know from a biblical standpoint of heaven and hell. We were talking about those two topics. We're going to finish that up this evening. And then finally, how do I get myself prepared for the second coming and for the final judgment? So that's what we're going to strive to do as we think about eternity and life beyond this existence, as we look into the great beyond, and where will we spend our eternity. And so in that discussion, we looked at heaven. And from a biblical standpoint, what does the Bible teach us about heaven? What are some things we can know? And then as we were looking last week, we got into a discussion of hell and what can we know about it? What does the Bible have to say? And so as we were doing so, we were looking at some terminology of some things, different terms that are brought out in Scripture. We've looked at the word Sheol, which is a Hebrew term referring to the grave. We looked at Hades or Hadas, right? And that again is like Sheol. It's a reference to the grave, the period of time where departed souls go after death. And then we looked at the term that Peter uses, Tartarus, which I believe is a reference to that place in Hades where the tormented souls are, where you see the rich man in Jesus explaining of the events that occurred to the rich man and Lazarus. And so as we were talking about last week, this final one is the one, biblically, is the one that we most often think about in regard to hell, and which I believe is the one that should be properly translated, and it's the Greek term, Gehenna. It is the term that is used in reference to the place of eternal punishment. It is defined as the valley of Hinnom, or the sons of Hinnom. It's a valley in Jerusalem that we'll get into the history of that in just a minute. It's used 12 times in the New Testament. And interestingly enough, 11 of those 12 are used by Jesus. The only other time it's used is by James when he's talking about the tongue and the damage that a tongue can do, our words. There's those references to when this term is used, all 12 of them. Several times there, or a couple times in the Sermon on the Mount. All right, so let's talk about that valley. So as I mentioned, the literal translation of Gehenna is the Valley of Hinnom, or the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. Where do we see that in Scripture? Well, let's look at a couple of those references. It helps to explain why Jesus uses this term, I believe. If you go to Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 35, I believe we read this one last week. But here, Jeremiah the prophet is looking at the corruption that the foreign people have brought into the children of Israel, the evil things they were doing. And in verse 35, he says, they built high places of Baal in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to offer up their sons and daughters to Molech. Though I did not command them, nor did it enter into my mind, this is God speaking, did enter into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. So he's talking about one of the great evil practices that Judah had found itself getting involved in, was in this child sacrifice, where they would literally send their children into these fires to offer them up to the god of Molech. A very disgraceful thing. You can see again in the text how many times God reemphasizes this idea of how evil this is. He says that I did not command it. It didn't even enter into my mind. He calls it an abomination and a sin. And as we noted last week as well, in Leviticus 18:21, as God tries to prepare the children of Israel to go into the promised land, what did he warn them about? This very thing. Leviticus 18:21, you shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. So God tried to warn them. He tried to, ahead of time, to caution them toward this evil practice. And yet, as you read in Jeremiah, that was the very thing they'd gotten caught up in. Again, in Jeremiah chapter 7, a little bit lengthy, longer reading, but I want to notice what's going on here. All right, Jeremiah 7 and verse 30. Jeremiah, again, speaking about this evil practice. Notice what he writes. Jeremiah 7 and 30. For the sons of Judah have done evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house that is called by my name to defile it. It's talking about the temple and how they defiled it. That's one of the things they had done. They have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. Notice what they did. So they set a high place, a sacrificial place, in the valley of Hinnom to do what? To burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. That same phrase repeated again here in Jeremiah 7. God says, this is not something I asked for. This is not something I would even imagine doing. I'm talking about how much of an abomination this is. So that's what they've allowed themselves to do. Because they have allowed the evil people around them to influence them, now they've gone so far over into sin that they're even offering their children into the fire to this false god. You know, I think about Genesis chapter 6. What does the text say there? Genesis chapter 6, right before the flood, what is God's summation of the people? Yeah, they can't even think about good things. They're so given over into evil thinking. They're corrupt from the very inclination of thought. Well, I know that's talking about a different group of people, but that's where the children of Israel are headed. I mean, think about how evil of what they're doing. I mean, it's disgusting. And yet they're allowing themselves to do it. And so in verse 32, he tells them that judgment has been passed, right? Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no more be called Topheth or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but what? The valley of slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth because there is no room elsewhere. And the dead bones of this people will be food for the birds of the air for the beasts of the earth. No one will frighten them away. And I will silence in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, for the land shall become a waste. So as God lays out this prophecy through Jeremiah, what does he say about this particular valley, this area where they have devoted to this worship of Molech? Okay. He says that they're going to be buried there because of their evil practice. They're going to be, essentially what he says is they're going to be left out for the animals to devour them, their bodies. And one of the things, getting in the mindset of the day, if you're an army and you defeat another army, but yet you've lost some men, what do? You go and collect all of your dead soldiers. Why?
Yes.
Why do you do that?
Bring them back home to their families.
Okay. That's part of it. You get them back to their home, but there was real shame in being left to the birds to feed on your bodies. The way they, that was a real, that's a word I'm looking for, but that it was very shameful. And so the same kind of imagery is used here to talk about their shame. Also, you notice in verse 34, this idea that all joy and mirth are going to be taken away from this place. Notice what he says. It'll be silent. The streets, it'll be silent of what?
Mirth.
Gladness.
And the voice of the bridegroom.
Bridegroom or the bride, right? You think about weddings. Weddings typify what? Most, hopefully.
Joy,
gladness, all these ideas of happiness. There's celebration in the air when people get married, right? We make a big to-do about those things. They did too. That was important to them. But he says here, what? You're not going to have any of that. This is going to be a place of what? Waste. So he gives this prediction. We'll come back to that in just a minute. I can go ahead and say this. So as we get into Joshua 18, 16, Joshua lays out for where this kind of is. Some of these places are kind of hard to nail down. Looking backwards, we can kind of get an idea of where these locations are. But if you read Joshua 18, 16, he says, "Then the boundary goes down to the border of the mountain." He's talking about Jerusalem. Down to the border of the mountain that overlooks the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is at the north end of the valley of Rephaim, and it goes down to the valley of Hinnom, right? You see that mentioned twice there. South of the border of the Jebusite down toward Engerold. You see on the map here, there you have the city of David, and then down below here is where we believe the valley of the sons of Hinnom was located. It was down below here. As time progressed forward, of course, what God prophesied came true. This became a place of waste. It became kind of a garbage dump through time. It became notorious for that as time went ahead. So the reason I bring this up, get into the mind of Jesus for just a minute, or try to, right? Why is he bringing up Gehenna to describe the place of eternal punishment? Why is he bringing that up? Well, think about it like this. When Jesus was teaching in parables, what did he often use? What did he always use? Something they're familiar with. You think about the parable of the sower and the seed and the soils, right? He could show them something, right, that they knew about. You think about when he's teaching about the net in the water. You know, that's something they understood in fishing. They understood those kind of concepts. So why does he bring up the valley of the sons of Hinnom, Gehenna? Why does he even introduce this idea? Well, he had something to point out, right? That the Jewish people would have understood. They understood the corruption of the history of that place. They understood what it meant even in their day. And so he's using that as a way to illustrate this place of eternal destruction, this place of eternal judgment of sin. And so he used this term Gehenna, like I said, 11 times throughout the Gospels. It's recorded for us. And so that's kind of the backdrop of the teaching of hell. And of course, now we just simply translate it as hell. One thing I haven't done is I'd like to go back and word search where hell developed, because that's the English word. I wonder where that came from. I just thought about that. I've never done that before. But in our way of thinking, Gehenna, the place of eternal punishment, it's on the backdrop of this valley of the sons of Hinnom, of what took place there. Now, when hell is talked about in the New Testament, how is it often described? Think of the different descriptors that you just know. Like, well, what comes to your mind as Jesus talked about it?
Darkness.
Hot. What?
It's hot.
Heat.
Fire and brimstone.
Fire. Isn't that interesting? Heat, fire, right? There's that connection. Darkness, waste, destruction, what?
Torture.
Eternal separation from God.
Separation. And all of those seem to be allusions back to what the evil that took place in that place. Those were a way to really describe what he's talking about when he talks about hell. Well, you think about the evilness of what the children of Israel allowed themselves to get into and what happened to that place over time. Okay, that's a way to at least kind of understand what hell is. Questions? All right, so that's kind of the backdrop of the term. But what about from a New Testament perspective? What can we learn about hell? What does the Bible say about it? All right, so how is it described? I have a few things I want to point out, and you may have some additional thoughts. But first, I want you to note something I think is kind of significant. Number one, hell was never intended for mankind. Did you know that? You know that? Matthew chapter 25. Thing is slow. All right, Matthew 25:41. Let's read that together. What does Jesus say? He's talking about in Matthew 25. What's the context? The day of judgment, right? When he parts one on the right and left. As he gets to the punishment for those who are on the left, what does he say? Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal what? Fire." Prepared for who? For the devil and his angels. When we think about the concept of eternal punishment, who was it originally designed for? Satan and his followers. Whoever those were. And when you get to the book of Revelation, chapter 20 and verse 10, as John is given this vision, one of the things he sees is what? The culmination of that punishment. Revelation 20 and verse 10. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Well, the first thing we note is that this place of eternal punishment was designed not for mankind, but for Satan and his angels. And we also have to get over the false premise that the devil is the king of hell. Now, I know that's popular in movies and things. He's the ruler of hell. No, he's not. Just as much as everybody else is going to be suffering, and so is he. This was meant as his punishment and not somewhere for him to rule. When time comes, he'll be cast in there as well. So number one, it was never intended for mankind. I'm getting like that old guy who's just learned how to get the remote going, and you know, you sort of jab it at the TV. I remember when there was just three buttons on there. All right, so number two, when we think about hell and how it's described in scriptures, it's a place of separation from God and all that is good and pleasant. And I wanted to add those that last phrase because I think that's really important. And there's a connection between separation from God and the separation from all that is good. When you go back to Matthew 25:41, and in Jesus condemning these people, he says, "Depart what? From me." If you go to Matthew chapter 7 and you look at verses 20 and following, what's the text note about? There are certain individuals who come to Jesus on Judgment Day, and what do they proclaim?
They did all these good works in his name.
And how did Jesus end that discussion?
He never knew you.
I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Right, this idea of separation, and not a temporary separation, but one of permanency. Hell is a place where we are separated from God permanently. When you think about that concept, number one, we think about just the loss of fellowship with God. That in itself is a torment. But it's not just a separation from God, which it is, but it's also a separation from all that he does. When we think about the Bible, we think about who God is. The Bible describes God in several different ways. It says God is love, right? That's what John says. What else do we know about? God is just. God is good. What does Jesus say to the rich young man? He says, "Why do you call me? Why do you call me good? No one's good except God," right? God is all that it means to be God, to be good. So in hell, you are separated from all of those things. There is no love in hell. There is no goodness in hell. There is no kindness in hell. There is no righteousness in hell. All of those things it's a place devoid of all of those things. And so I think it's important to make that connection with that. You know, some people jokingly say, "Well, I want to be in hell. That's where all my friends are." I mean, I know people say that, don't really take time to think about it. But it's not going to be a party. I know even at times they depict hell as some kind of practice, where a place where people just are free to practice whatever sin they want to practice. There's going to be no practicing of sin. It's going to be a place of punishment. It's like if you you murder somebody and you get taken to prison, do they let you keep murdering people? No. I mean, you might do that, but then they put you in solitary confinement, right? They don't, like, you're restricted from all those things. And so when you think about hell, it's a place devoid of anything good.
Hey, Brian. While you're waiting for that next scripture to come up. We have a hard time with that concept, because even people who do evil here and who are evil and are continually doing evil and inventing new evil, they're blessed with a lot of good. Like there's constant good. Like even people who hate the country, or people who, there's a lot of good that just comes from being in a country that has some Christian values, right? That has some, that's founded on those things, regardless of how long. And so it's hard to really understand, you know, you kind of think you're running and you're doing your own thing and things aren't that bad. Well, it's not that bad because God has the reign on the just and the unjust. You know, this is far from a place that's devoid, you know, it's devoid from God's influence and presence. And you know, you have people, millions of people who are still praying and who still reach out to God and who still, so his providence and influence is still here, even if you're doing, you know, you're benefiting from the crumbs and from the effects of people who do turn the other cheek and people who do give freely and people who do, but when that's all gone, I mean, it's really gone. Like there's, you know, so we don't ever experience a place on this earth where it's gone, no matter how bad you are here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, you're just saying, I think that capitalizes really well. What does James say, that God, that the that God sends the rain on the just and the unjust, right? There are just benefits to being in this world because God's touch is still on this world. His influence is still here. And I think also there's this concept that even those who practice evil things believe, well, I'll have another chance, right? There's always that opportunity to change. Hell isn't going to be like that. In hell, there are no second chances. It's just over. And we have a tough time, you know, I think, kind of wanting to admit that reality. Turner?
Yeah. To what Patrick's saying, you know, Abraham, you know, witnessed that. You know, if there's only 10 righteous in that whole group, you know, would mm-hmm. I spare? Yes, he would. And so, his point. Also, you know, you made a comment about, you know, people thinking, and I've heard this comment bunches of times, you know, I've been with my friends. Well, Bob says it'll be total darkness. How will you know your friends are there amongst millions and trillions of people in agony, okay? You won't know any friends. On the flip side, you know, you've heard the comment, well, I'm worried about when I go to heaven, I might mess up there. Well, no, you won't. The devil is going to be there. He's not going to be there to tempt you in heaven. Okay, so you don't have to worry about that. So he's going to be down there with the millions and the trillions. You know.
Well, the reverse is true, right? Where, as in hell, there is no God presence. So there is no good or love or anything. But in heaven, it'll only be God. And it'll only be those experiences of goodness, of righteousness, of holiness, and all those concepts where it'll be completely devoid of sin and evil. Now, that's also hard for us to conceptualize. We only know a world of a duality in morality. Ooh, there you go. It's a nice little rhyme. Y'all write a poem to that, or a song. But I was thinking about the song... what's the name of the song, you all who have better memories than me? There's a song we sing about how as Christians we see those who are evil seemingly doing well. Farther along, we'll understand why, right? But it's hard now. But this, in hell, we have to make the realization that those things are gone. And there is no second opportunities. There is no touch of God on hell. And it'll be a place completely devoid of that. Finally, as it comes up this time quicker, it'll be a place of eternal punishment. And I really want this to ring true in our ears and in those we're trying to reach. This concept of of it being eternal. If you go back to Matthew 25:41, Jesus again, speaking to those who are being punished, what does he say to them? You depart from me, you cursed, into what? The eternal fire. I know it becomes a popular idea for some to teach that hell is just a way to God or for Jesus to illustrate the, you know, that the evil of sin, right? And it's just like an illustration. It's not true. There's a couple problems with that. Number one, Jesus said flat out, eternal. Number two, what's the comparison hell is made with? It's balanced on heaven. The same terminology used to describe hell as eternal is used to describe heaven as eternal. So if I take away the everlasting eternal heaven, I mean term from heaven, I've got to take it away from the other side too, or from hell. I have to do it to heaven as well. And that's just simply not how the Bible describes it. It is described as a place of eternal punishment. Now, again, I mean, that's a hard concept to grasp. The thought of never-ending punishment. But that's the way the Bible describes it. And I don't have to understand it completely or to how it's possible to understand that it's a reality. And it's something I need to realize and to be motivated by. Yes, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one of the problems that we have sometimes as, I don't know, a nation, is everybody looks at hell like, well, it's just the boogeyman, kind of. Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
You know, if you do bad things, you go there, but they don't look at it like the Bible says it is. I mean, nobody can even picture literally being in absolute pain every minute of every day, forever.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other things that go along with it, that there's no goodness there, nobody's laughing there, you're never going to have anything that is going to be pleasant, even just a little tiny bit. But we still look at it a lot of times like it's just this boogeyman place, and like, you know, people joke about it with the, you know, all my friends are there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they are, they'd be willing to tell you, please don't come here.
No, absolutely. Well, to kind of go along with what you were saying about this idea, in Matthew 13, as Jesus again describes this place, Matthew 13 and 41, he said, the Son of Man will send out his angels, talking about Judgment Day, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers. Notice this, and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, Jesus uses several kind of ways to try to describe what's going on here. And I was, you know, Dwayne describing this concept of being in pain constantly. When we think about pain, it's not just one type of pain. You've had a toothache, probably. Most of us probably have. Toothaches are bad, right? Because sometimes they're just that constant gnawing pain. And it's a physical pain. But is that the only kind of pain that we experience? No. I mean, you think about the psychological pain that we go through sometimes. Think about the emotional pain that we suffer. And sometimes those can be far worse. When you're in hell, it's not just physical pain. Number one, I'm not sure we're going to be physical beings at that moment. I think it's that kind of emotional, intellectual, spiritual pain. That you've been ripped away from your Creator. You've been put in this place where you're never going to know what it means to be happy. To never know what it means to be joyous. To never know what it means to be glad or mirth, you know, feelings of mirth and just, you know, euphoria. Those things are gone. That in many ways to me is as disturbing as any part of it. It's not going to be that happy reunion that some people talk about. You're not going to be down there like, oh, Joe, man, it's so good to see you and everything. You're going to be consumed with your own pain, your own torture, not to worry about what others is. What's going on with other people, as we mentioned earlier too, you know, it's described as a place of fire, of heat, of gnashing and weeping, gnashing of teeth. It's also described in Matthew 8:12 as a place of darkness. I don't like horror movies, never watch them. But you know something that equally scary to me that you see in movies sometimes is outer space. That kind of terrifies me, to be honest. I'm going to be the last guy to get on Elon's spaceship and go to Mars. Because I just know ours is going to get off course, our jet's going to break up, and I'm going to be out there in outer space just floating forever in darkness. Right? That is scary to me. I'm also a little bit claustrophobic, right, for those same mistakes. Being shut up in a tiny box is just, it sends shivers down my spine. And here's this picture Jesus is using. You're thrown out into outer darkness. A place of complete darkness. A place where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That ought to be a motivator for any of us and others as we try to teach them. Hell is not a place you want to find yourself. So as we kind of bring this study to a close, and we talked about these big kind of concepts. I don't know how far I'll get on this, but we'll get as far as we can. In Matthew 24, verse 13, Jesus exhorts us and exhorts his disciples to do what? To endure to the end. He says in Matthew 24, 13, "But the one who endures to the end will be saved." I know sometimes we talk about obeying the gospel as being saved. And yes, that does get us on the road to salvation, but it is not the end. Again, we're reminded of what Jesus says. The one who endures to the end will be saved. It's the same kind of concept that Paul writes to Timothy in 2 Timothy, right? When he says, I'm ready to be offered as a drink offering. I know my time is approaching. And then he goes on to say, there is waiting for me a crown, which is not for me only, but what? But also for those who are waiting for him. Those who are enduring to the end, eagerly awaiting his return. And so we'll finish this up next week. We'll look at this concept of how do I get myself prepared? How do I know I am prepared when Jesus comes back? Thank you so much. We'll rejoin in just a minute for our devotional time. Again, it's good to see you and be together this evening. Thank you.